the identification of Palestine with terrorism and all Palestinians with terrorism, barbarism, and animality, then there are no civilians in the imaginary of those who are doing violence to them.
We want to thank.
And that's false, and it has to be opposed. Thank
you. We want to thank you for being with us. We're going to continue with part two of our discussion and post it at democracynow.org. Judith Butler is a philosopher, political commentator, and gender studies scholar, distinguished professor in the Graduate School at University of California, Berkeley, and the Hannah Arendt Chair at the European Graduate School on the advisory board of Jewish Voice for Peace. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh for another edition of Democracy Now!
You're tuned to listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
KBOO's fall membership drive is almost over. We invite you to become a member right now by going to kboo.fm/give or by texting KBOO to the number 44321. Contribute during this last week of the drive, and your donation will be matched dollar for dollar up to $14,000, thanks to the generous support of a group of donors. So hurry and join the KBOO family today and help us meet our $55,000 goal at kboo.fm/give. Together, we can do it.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud media sponsor of the Día de los Muertos celebration on Wednesday, November 1st, from 12 to 10 p.m. at The Red on Salmon Street in Portland. Día de los Muertos is an ancient celebration originating from the indigenous people of Mexico. Festivities will include altar creation, muertos face painting, sugar skull decorating, traditional Mexican food, and live musical performances. Again, that's the Día de los Muertos celebration on Wednesday, November 1st, from 12 to 10 p.m. at The Red on Salmon Street, A31 Southeast Salmon Street in Portland.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on this fall membership drive edition of the KBOO Evening News, strikes are impacting healthcare workers in the Northwest again. The health of the environment takes center stage at a town hall with one of Oregon's U.S. senators. And how people in the Northwest need to find solutions for long-term care.
If somebody doesn't have long-term care insurance, then they're really looking at family and friends, maybe helping take care of them or purchasing services out of pocket.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, October 26, 2023. KBOO is currently in our fall membership drive, and we'd like to urge you to become a member by going online to kboo.fm/give. I'm Annette Newell. Thanks for joining us. A pollinator apocalypse, Oregon's canyons under threat, and reducing plastics pollution. These are among the topics at a town hall on the environment the Oregon League of Conservation Voters held it this afternoon with U.S. Senator Jeff Merkley, who sounded the alarm on several fronts.
Let's start with the Owyhee Canyonlands.
Yeah.
Which I suspect may be a top priority or top three priority for you all.
Yes.
Senator Wyden's the lead on this, and his team has worked so hard with stakeholders like yourselves, stakeholders in the community, for years of dialogue and strategy to find a collaborative path forward. We've made a lot of progress, 1.1 million acres of federal lands in the Owyhee Canyonlands and Owyhee River. It's a national treasure, one that too few Oregonians have witnessed. Fish and wildlife and sage grouse, lands that are sacred to native tribes. And we also know that such lands can be damaged if they're not protected from maluse or misuse or overuse. And so this is why it's a matter. We often talk about Hell's Canyon is Oregon's Grand Canyon. That's also a term that's being applied, if you will, to the Owyhee Canyonlands. It's a visit both of Oregon's Grand Canyons because they're both magnificent. Let's find a way to get this bill forward. And it's really a double strategy, as we have on a number of our wilderness bills. That is the possibility of a monument for a conversation and the possibility of legislation, and kind of realizing both have significant flexibility to accommodate the many stakeholder concerns and interests that have arisen and been put forward and been accommodated in the course of working on this bill for a long time. Second, I want to address pollinators. I'm deeply struck by the fact that when I was a kid and we would take a car drive, by the time I got to a gas station, the windshield would be covered. It's like, okay, son, you know, get out and clean the windshield and scrub all those bugs off. And now you're, you know, if there's one bug splattered, you're kind of, oh, I wonder what kind of bug that was. It's a whole different world. We really had an insect apocalypse. And it's, you know, generally the result of increased development and increased use of pesticides. But flowering plants and insects go together, and they're very important. And the way we have more insects is to have more plants and be much more conscious about that. 75% of the world's flowering plants and 35% of the world's food crops depend on pollinators. I have focused on the monarch because, one, the over 30 years, we were down to less than 1% of the traditional number of monarchs. Many people think they've seen a monarch when they've seen any yellow butterfly or maybe yellow-orange butterfly, but it's really actually very rare. I encourage you all to take a picture if you see one so we can kind of track a little bit of their territory. We had one good year that took us back from just, we were down to 2,000 monarchs counted, 2,000. Wow.
That's hard to fathom. 2000.
Just impossible to fathom. Fortunately, yeah. We had a great year. We had a rebound. When things go right, they go through four generations coming north. And if things go right in the first couple generations, they can expand very rapidly. But think about if we had pollinator plots along our highways, which I now have authorized an initial funding for. Think about if we had conservation easements where massive fields that would otherwise be under conservation easements but unplanted were planted with pollinating flowers. Think about if we had a program where the flowers you buy in the local store, some of them are marked monarch safe, meaning pesticide free. Because right now we have a big problem. If you want to plant a garden in your home, a butterfly garden, a pollinator garden, you may be planting plants that have so much pesticide on them, they actually kill things. So having a pathway to actually be able to buy pesticide-free plants, make it a big profit center for the nursery industry, it'd be a big win-win. So those are all pieces. I've been holding monarch/pollinator conferences through the Interior Department because of my role as chair of the Interior Spending Committee. And it's been powerful to bring all these experts together and identify some of these key problems and what we could do about it. Third, I wanted to address the Inflation Reduction Act. The incentives that are in there are going to make a big difference in deployment of renewable energy. There's $369 billion in climate provisions. Oregon is going to see a significant amount of that funding. We're about, think about us being about 1% of the country. So if you hear $369 billion, a good chance that $3.5 to $4 billion are going to come to Oregon in various ways. One of those is a program to plant and maintain trees, cool heat islands, expand access to nature. Another is for transit districts for low and no emission vehicles. I like the no emission vehicle side of that. Energy efficient improvements to help rural business owners and farmers lower energy costs, but it also means that when you lower your energy costs because you're consuming less energy, that means you need less electricity and we have a better chance of renewable energy becoming the sole vision for how we generate electricity. That is a key goal of President Biden's, was to have 100% electricity be fossil free by 2035. To do that, we have to deploy some 3 billion solar panels. So 3 billion, take 1% of that, and you can see how much work we have to do to capture sun in Oregon. I like to think of it as the best fusion energy program. The sun is a fusion reactor, if you will, and we're capturing that energy at a distance and putting it to work. Every single thing we do has some impact. Obviously, if you have a solar panel on the ground, that's, you're not going to have a plant in that same location. But one thing you can do is plant plants in between the solar panels. Well, we have a lot of work to do on every front, on our buildings, certainly on our transportation, and certainly in our generation of electricity, certainly in our homes, eliminating fossil gas in favor of electricity. If you want to kind of capture what our challenges, think of this phrase, electrify everything with renewable integrated energy.
That was Oregon U.S. Senator Jeff Merkley speaking at a town hall with the Oregon League of Conservation Voters today. A mine exploration project near the Boise River is raising some alarms. Eric Tegedoff has the story.
The Idaho Copper Corporation is seeking approval from the U.S. Forest Service to look for copper and molybdenum used in steel alloys about 50 miles north of Boise. Critics of the project worry it will disturb the environment and also about the company's ultimate plan to build a large open-pit mine. Nick Kunith with Idaho Rivers United says water quality is a major concern.
Being at the headwaters of a major tributary to the Boise River, which is one of the primary drinking water sources for the city of Boise and the most densely populated area in the state, if there are any issues with water contamination or a spill, it's highly problematic and concerning.
The Boise River provides about 30% of Boise's drinking water supply and helps irrigate farmland in the area, according to conservation groups. Idaho Copper says exploration will have minimal environmental impacts on the region. The Forest Service is accepting public comment on the proposal through November 2nd. Similar proposals in the area have been struck down by the courts twice before, in 2012 and 2016. However, John Robison with the Idaho Conservation League says because of the mining law of 1872, the Forest Service can't deny exploration projects in the area.
If we do projects like this in the same way and putting vulnerable areas at risk, we're going to end up with the same problems or worse problems. Instead, we need to protect the areas that really matter to community water supplies and figure out how to responsibly manage mining moving forward.
Kunith says the Forest Service's public comment period is an opportunity for recreational users like backcountry skiers and anglers to be part of this process.
Whatever it is, if you use this area and have questions about how this project, even at this early exploration stage, will impact the reasons that you care about this area or what may change, this is the best time to have your voice heard and potentially steer the direction of this project.
I'm Eric Tegeda.
It's been a record year for healthcare workers going on strike in Oregon and Southwest Washington. Kaiser Permanente Imaging workers are the latest to say they're hitting the picket lines November 1st through 18th. Kaiser's pharmacy workers are already on strike and extending their outage till the 18th as well. Peace Health workers in Southwest Washington are on strike through Saturday. Earlier this year, Providence nurses held Oregon's first nurses' strike in more than a decade. And there was the largest health worker strike in history, also involving Kaiser Permanente, this year. Researchers with the government say they're finding healthcare workers report burnout and mental health problems. Yesterday, doctors, including the CDC's chief medical officer, Deborah Oury, announced findings in a new report.
Workers in health-related professions have historically faced long work hours, often with unpredictable or rotating schedules, or like what I experienced as an emergency physician, working overnights and on holidays. Caring for people who are sick can also be intensely stressful and emotional. Exposure to human suffering takes an immense toll on this vital workforce. Although you do everything you can to save a life, I still remember some of the tough patient cases I had where I gave the bad news about an advanced cancer diagnosis to a working spouse, or the time I was unable to resuscitate a young toddler after a car crash. After a shift like this, I would have to put on a good front and take care of my own family. And in doing this, I didn't always pay enough attention to my own wellness needs. The COVID-19 pandemic only intensified many health workers' long-standing challenges and contributed to new and worsening concerns, including compassion fatigue, depression, anxiety, substance use disorders, and suicidal thoughts. Burnout among these workers has reached crisis levels. While usually health workers care diligently for others in their time of need, it is now our nation's health workers who are suffering, and we must act. CDC's National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health, also known as NIOSH, is actively working to help address this issue through the new Health Worker Mental Health Initiative. One goal of the initiative is to raise awareness of health workers' mental health issues, particularly focusing on the role that work conditions play and what employers can do. As part of this initiative, this fall, NIOSH will be launching a national campaign for hospital leaders, focusing on providing them resources to help them think differently about how to identify and remove barriers to health worker well-being. The data presented in today's Vital Signs report further support the imperative given in the U.S. Surgeon General's 2022 report addressing health worker burnout, which emphasized the need for action to create a system where health workers can thrive. Today's Vital Signs report is one of the many critical research projects focused on health workers to learn more about their mental health needs and what strategies can address those needs to optimize their well-being. Now I'll turn it over to Dr. Casey Chosewood.
Our nation's health workers continue to face a mental health crisis. The number of days U.S. health workers reported their mental health was not good in the past 30 days increased more than other workers between 2018 and 2022, the time span before and after the start of the COVID-19 pandemic. Health workers were also more likely than other workers to report negative changes in their working conditions during this time. Notably, health workers reported the largest increase in being harassed at work compared to other workers. And sadly, this report points out that health workers who reported being harassed were more likely to report symptoms of anxiety, depression, and burnout compared to health workers who did not report being harassed. Specifically, the analysis showed that 46%, or nearly half of all health workers, reported often feeling burned out in 2022, an increase from 32% in 2018. Additionally, more than double the number of health workers reported harassment at work in 2022 compared to 2018. Intentions by health workers to change jobs also increased, with 44% in 2022 reporting they were likely or very likely to look for a new job in the next year. In comparison, other worker groups reported a decrease in job turnover intention. But our analysis also showed places where there is hope that we can improve the outlook for this workforce. Importantly, the Vital Signs report noted that poor mental health outcomes are less common when working conditions are positive and where health workers have the potential to thrive. Supportive work environments had a positive impact on health workers. For example, the data show that the odds of depression symptoms were half when health workers could take part in workplace decisions. The bottom line is this: we must take the research we have and act. Data such as those presented in this Vital Signs report are giving us crucial and concerning information. To label our current and longstanding challenge a crisis is an understatement. Many of our nation's healthcare systems are at their breaking point. Staffing crises, lack of supportive leadership, long hours of work, and excessive demands and inflexibilities in our nation's health systems all must be addressed. We're calling on employers to take this information to heart and take immediate preventive actions. We know from previous research that organizational, system-wide interventions are more effective than individually focused intervention approaches, or those that rely on the worker to take the initiative to address their own mental health concerns. We don't just want to treat workers who are suffering. We want to prevent that harm to all workers in the first place. The ultimate goal is to build a sustainable infrastructure for future generations of health workers that optimizes the culture of healthcare settings. In accomplishing these goals, we expect to have a positive impact on multiple organizational and employee outcomes.
And those doctors were announcing the results of a new survey showing that American healthcare workers are struggling with their own mental health. As Americans live longer lives, long-term care is becoming more crucial. It's important to think about your finances and start planning early, according to experts. Eric Tegedov talks to the Assistant Secretary of Aging in the Washington State Department of Social and Health Services.
October is Long-Term Care Planning Month, and a few tips can help people understand where to start when it comes to thinking about the future. Affording care is among the most critical pieces of planning. Bea Rector is with the Washington State Department of Social and Health Services Aging and Long-Term Support Administration. She says people typically can't rely on health insurance to cover these costs.
If somebody doesn't have long-term care insurance, then they're really looking at family and friends maybe helping take care of them or purchasing services out of pocket. Or, of course, there's the safety net program that is Medicaid.
Rector says in-home care or being in a facility outside the home can be costly. She notes that many people receive care from a loved one, which can reduce costs but also comes with burdens on the person providing it. Rector says Washington is the only state in the country with a program that workers pay into in order to fund long-term care. The WA Cares Fund will provide access to up to $36,500 in benefits starting in 2026. The amount will be adjusted for inflation going forward. Rector says the money is flexible.
That can be used to pay for a wide variety of things, from home modifications to wheelchair ramps to personal care services in the home or even services out of the home like in an adult family
memory home or assisted living facility.
Rector says it's essential to start planning early.
Really making sure that the loved ones around you know what you want that to look like, and making sure that you've got decision-making supports put in place, things like durable power of attorneys, et cetera, so that financial or health care decisions can be made by someone that you trust.
I'm Eric Tegedoff.
You're listening to a fall membership drive edition of the KBOO Evening News. Our goal is to raise $55,000 by the end of October. We'd like to remind you that you can renew your KBOO membership or become a member at any time during this program by going online to kboo.fm/give. Stay tuned after this newscast for the Global Citizen International Digest with Mil Gertov. At 5:45, stick around for KBOO News In Depth. We're talking to folks from the Blue Mountains Biodiversity Project about their upcoming Autumn Celebration benefit. At 6, it's Rose City Native Radio. Then at 7, American Indian Airwaves. Tonight's weather, we have a freeze watch and a frost advisory from midnight tonight till 9 a.m. Friday. We'll have clear skies, a low down to about 36. Tomorrow's weather, sunny skies, up to 53. Today in history, on this date in 2001, President George W. Bush signed the Patriot Act, billing it as an anti-terrorism law in response to the September 11th attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. The quote of the day is from Naomi Wolf. After we were hit on September 11th, 2001, we were in a state of national shock. Less than 6 weeks later, on October 26, 2001, the USA Patriot Act was passed by a Congress that had little chance to debate it. Many said that they scarcely had time to read it. Hard-right Republican Congressman Mike Johnson's elected Speaker of the U.S. House. President Trump is fined again in his New York civil case. With more on the stories impacting our democracy, here's today's edition of 2023 Talks.
I want to thank you all for the trust that you have instilled in me to lead us in this historic and unprecedented moment that we're in. The challenge before us is great, but the time for action is now, and I will not let you down.
Louisiana Republican Mike Johnson will be the new Speaker of the House after winning a 220-209 vote. Johnson's record puts him near the right edge of the Republican caucus, voting against certifying the 2020 election and leading support for a lawsuit challenging it. But Johnson's calling for collaboration and says he'll form a bipartisan commission on the nation's debt. House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries voiced Democrats' reservations, citing a federal Don't Say Gay bill Johnson sponsored and his calls for a strict nationwide abortion ban. But Jeffries is also reaffirming a commitment to bipartisanship for the sake of American democracy.
This is a turbulent time in the American journey, and we have but one charge to keep during this moment of great fragility. Our union must be sustained. Our union must be strengthened. Our union must succeed.
The United Auto Workers Union and Ford have reached a tentative agreement which could end a big part of a massive strike. The details are still emerging, but recent talks have centered around 25% wage increases and improved benefits. If approved, this could become a model for deals with General Motors and Stellantis. Meanwhile, former President Donald Trump was fined another $10,000 for violating a gag order after testifying in his New York civil trial on Wednesday. Trump insisted his typical comments were about witness and former Trump employee Michael Cohen, but many feel the real target was court staff, who he's attacked on social media before. After discussions with former Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell says China, Russia, and Iran constitute a new axis of evil, echoing an Iraq War-era phrase.
Now we have terrorism, and we have big power competition. So this is the broadest threat to the democratic world than we've had since before the Berlin Wall came down.
I'm Edwin J. Vieira.
A new survey about political violence shows that most Republicans prefer a candidate who can preserve American culture, while most Democrats and independents prefer a candidate who can manage the economy. Alex Gonzalez reports.
A federal judge recently dismissed a lawsuit challenging Nevada's election worker protection law. Senate Bill 406 created new safeguards to protect election officials from intimidation and interference. Will they be needed? In this increasingly divided nation, a new survey by the Public Religion Research Institute has found an overwhelming majority of Americans believe the future of American democracy is at stake in the 2024 presidential election. President and founder of PRRI, Robert Jones, says another concerning finding is that more believe political violence might be necessary.
We found that this attitude has actually gone up over the last 2 years, right? So in the country, it's now a quarter of Americans, 23%, who say that true American patriots may have to resort to violence in order to save the country. It has gone to fully a third of Republicans.
Jones says that attitude has garnered support across the political spectrum, although Republicans are 2.5 times more likely to support it due to their perceptions that the United States is off track and the 2020 election was stolen from former President Donald Trump. Liliana Mason, who teaches political science at Johns Hopkins University, says Democrats and Republicans are likely to have different interpretations of the term political violence. She explains Democrats often tend to think of it in terms of property damage, while Republicans think of armed resistance. She calls the findings daunting and says leaders on both sides of the aisle need to play more active roles in condemning violence of any kind.
The one very easy thing for us to do, not easy, but concrete thing for us to do is to try to encourage our leaders to make it very, very clear to their supporters and to people who trust them and follow them that these types of attitudes do not have a place in a healthy democracy.
The survey highlights that a majority of younger voters, millennials, Gen X, and Gen Z, prefer a president who can best manage the economy, while older voters and the baby boomer and silent generations prefer a president who can preserve and protect American culture. I'm Alex Gonzalez.
Emotional testimony during a stop on a Road to Healing tour. And a judge approves a $23 billion settlement for First Nations racial discrimination. With that story and more, here's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
It was an emotional day at the Alaska Native Heritage Center in Anchorage, where the U.S. Interior Secretary spent Sunday listening to Native boarding school survivors. KNBA's Rhonda McBride has more. And a trigger warning for our audience, this story contains testimony of child sexual abuse.
Interior Secretary Deb Haaland told the gathering her name in Karis is Crushed Turquoise. She says her family's knowledge of their language fractured after a priest took her grandmother away at the age of 8 on a train to a Catholic boarding school. There, she was punished for speaking Karis and quit using it so it wasn't passed on. Today, Haaland says she understands some of the language, but can't speak it.
This is the first time in history that a United States cabinet secretary comes to the table with the same trauma that all of you have.
Many of these children were as young as 5 years old.
Jim LaBelle was the first to share his story. He was only 8 years old when the government took him away from his mother, along with his younger brother, Kermit. When LaBelle was sent to the Wrangell Institute in 1955, he was bilingual.
I quickly shut down my Inupiaq side because I saw so many of my fellow students beaten in so many different ways.
There was the gauntlet, in which a naked child would be forced to run past a row of kids who lined up to strike them with their belts. And if they didn't hit hard enough, they would be punished too.
A lot of times that drew blood.
But LaBelle says that wasn't the worst of it.
Matrons were sodomizing boys in their beds or in the bathrooms. We saw girls going home in the middle of the school year pregnant.
LaBelle says the kids knew what was going on, but never told anyone. Dark secrets, which took a huge emotional toll.
A lot of trauma is carried on from one generation to the next.
Martha Sanungatuk says all Alaska Natives are in some way touched by boarding school abuse. In Anchorage, I'm Rhonda McBride.
A Canadian judge has approved a landmark $23 billion First Nations Child Welfare Compensation Agreement. Dan Karpinchuk reports.
The compensation, $23 billion, is the largest in Canadian history. It comes after a Canadian Human Rights Tribunal ruling in 2019. It ordered the Canadian government to pay the maximum human rights penalty for discrimination. That will work out to about $40,000 for each affected First Nations child and family member. Initially, Ottawa had fought the order, but negotiated a deal after it faced two class action lawsuits. Cindy Blackstock is the executive director of the First Nations Child and Family Caring Society.
It's a relief, but I also find myself thinking about the thousands of children, youth, and families who are hurt by Canada's discrimination, who will never get their childhoods back. And that's why, Dave, it's so important that we end the discrimination and prevent it from happening again.
About 300,000 First Nations children and their families will be entitled to the compensation. The settlement comes more than 15 years after the Assembly of First Nations Relations and the Child and Family Caring Society launched a human rights complaint. It centered on allegations that Ottawa's underfunding of on-reserve child welfare services amounted to discrimination and that First Nations children were denied equal access to support, including medical equipment and school supplies. In addition to the $23 billion in compensation, another $20 billion will be spent to reform the child welfare system. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Long-term warming is bringing some unwelcome treats for Halloween. The nonprofit Climate Central analyzed fall warming trends in 244 American cities and found 89% of them have seen October nights warm up since 1970.
As Halloween approaches, cooler temperatures will spread, but weather experts say climate change is making October nights feel warmer more often than not. A new analysis from the nonprofit Climate Central says fall evening temperatures in the U.S. have warmed by nearly 2 degrees on average since 1970. And it's even higher in cities like Madison and Milwaukee, which has seen increases of nearly 4 degrees when looking at minimum temps. Climate Central meteorologist Lauren Casey says it doesn't just affect traditional fall activities.
Allergy season has been lengthened by about a month in many locations.
She says that makes it more burdensome for people with more serious respiratory issues like asthma. And the analysis points out that mosquito season is being extended too. Casey says to help mitigate these trends, residents should do what they can to avoid energy sources that come from fossil fuels. And Casey says adapting to these changes is another important step so that folks aren't caught off guard when the calendar flips to October.
So you can best prepare if you do have asthma, you know, if you are potentially susceptible to mosquito-borne illnesses, all of these things which can impact our everyday lives.
For prolonged allergy seasons, health experts say vulnerable individuals should put some time and research into establishing a medication regimen that works for them. Meanwhile, Casey says the warmer weather results in heavier rain events, which attract more mosquitoes. This is Mike Moen.
You're listening to a fall membership drive edition of the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, October 26, 2023. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Paul Kim, Mel Gertov, Eric Tegedoff, Mike Moen, and Alex Gonzalez. The producer is Annette Newell, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Public News Service and Native Voice One.